You are listening to a University of North Carolina Kidney Center podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Falk, the director of the Kidney Center. Our goal today is to help you better understand vasculitis. Today, we'll be talking about how to live a full life as a vasculitis patient. Diane Shaw, our patient today, will be joining the discussion. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you. As an ANCA patient for 14 years, I've had to learn how to cope with living with the disease, and I hope to share some of my experiences as well as those of other patients to help others out there.
So what I think we're going to try to do today is to discuss some pretty broad topics, the first of which is how you can improve the quality of your life as a patient with vasculitis. So let's begin. When you were first diagnosed with ANCA vasculitis, the first positive measure that you took was to learn how to manage your disease. So let's talk for a while now about what strategies you've learned about how to manage your disease.
Well, I think the first strategy that any patient, and I was lucky because I was at a renowned vasculitis center. I think patients need to search for doctors who know vasculitis, who know this disease, and who treat it often, either by establishing themselves as a patient at that facility or by having their physician consult as needed with the Vasculitis Foundation medical consultants. That is really, really important. I think it starts you on a good path to getting good therapy, to doing all the things that you need to do to take care of yourself. The second thing that I did was to ask lots of questions, have those questions ready before each of your medical visits, get copies of your test results, and keep a notebook of your doctor visits and what was said. I know that sometimes when I'm on a lot of prednisone, I have a very foggy memory and I can't remember, so the notebook is especially useful then. Also, by having that notebook, you have more of a sense of continuity of your disease. It gives you some reassurance that, yes, here's this disease. I have all my information in one place. And it gives you, as if you ever have, some sense of control of this disease. To me, it was also important to be a part of my care team. You know, you and the team at UNC and most physicians anywhere who are treating vasculitis know that quite often it's the patient who is sort of the canary in the mine when a flare is coming on. And it's important that there's really good communication and trust among all the care team members. I also try to keep up with the science. That keeps me hopeful. There's a lot of information on the Vasculitis Foundation website and other websites that post current research on vasculitis, on ANCA. So those are just some of the strategies.
You've done a remarkable job of taking charge of your health, but you have all sorts of individual Diane Shaw strategies that I've witnessed over the course of time. How did you figure out about what those various tests meant, for example?
Well, I did a lot of searching on the web. I also ask you about them. I also talk to other patients when I go to support group meetings or to the international symposia. There's a lot of emphasis given to what is an ANCA test? What does it mean? What is normal? And then what is normal for you? Because not everybody measures the same way and it doesn't mean the same thing on each patient. So that was important, was to know what those test results mean.
How about reaction to medications?
Reactions to medications, well, you really have to know your body. You have to know how you are with a certain drug. For instance, when I'm on steroids, we know that if we start me really high, that I just freak out. I flip out and I'm gone for days. So we try to start it at a rational dose for me. And it took time to moderate and learn that dose. But knowing that is really important. And now when I'm having a surgery and they want to give me a taper of steroids, I say, let's start here because that works best for me.
And for you, that has worked out wonderfully. Well, what advice would you give to somebody who wants to and help their physician figure out the best prednisone dose, for example, Yeah, how would you suggest that that patient interact with their physician so as to get that physician not to come up with a cookbook prescription, but rather a patient-friendly, individualized dosage?
I think that it's noticing what happens to you. I think the first few times that you have steroid tapers, you'll see at a certain dose you can start sleeping at night. At a certain dose, you don't have to peel yourself off the ceiling every morning. And note that in your notebook so that when I'm at 28 milligrams, I can do this. If it's under 16, then I can sleep through the night. And noticing those things means that the next time you go and you're going to get a prescription for steroids, you can say, you know, the last few times I've had it, here's what I've noticed. And I've noticed that the symptoms diminish without a huge dose, and maybe we could start here. And then if we need to, we could go up. But what about starting at this dose?
So now, of course, you're at the point where I just do whatever you tell me to do with respect to the dosage. What did you do so that your coworkers, you're a full-time employed individual, so what do you do to help your coworkers, first of all, learn about your disease and then learn about how you may have reacted to these medications?
I have been pretty open with people in my office about my vasculitis, and they are uniformly supportive. I know that I'm very, very lucky. Some people choose to tell only a few people at work. I tell people when I'm on steroids. I say it jokingly. I say, I just want you to be aware that I'm starting a steroid taper at a high dose, and when I'm at this dose, if you ask me something, I will tell you, and I will try to keep myself under wraps, but just know that it's going to be rocky for me for a few days until I get down to a rational dose.
What would you advise for people who are not as willing to be as open with their coworkers? There are a lot of patients, for example, who really don't want to share anything about what they're going through with anybody in their working environment, which perhaps has a benefit of shielding the patient from too many prying questions, but on the other hand, has the downside of not allowing individuals in a supportive environment to weigh in at times when you or other patients really need them to weigh in. How would you help patients get over that? It's almost a hurdle of wanting to open up.
It is, because when you're first diagnosed, you feel so weird. You feel like you're now living on a different planet. You have a disease that nobody's heard of. Nobody knows what it is, how it affects you, what the therapies are. And so you tend to pull yourself back and pull inside. I think that talking maybe with people that you know you can talk with about stuff like this is a good start. I think that if you don't feel you can tell people at work, then you need to make a plan for yourself so that if you're on a huge taper of prednisone and you need to go home and sleep in the afternoon, then get your stuff done during the morning and take time off during the afternoon. Say you have a medical appointment or something and go home and sleep. But try to do things that will help you move along in your illness, but also stay at work as long as you can.
You almost invariably tell me a joke or two when you come to visit. What role does humor play in how you've managed your disease?
Humor for me plays an enormous role. I feel like it deflects pity in some people. I think that it shows that I have dealt with this, and that I'm moving on, that I am not just a person who has vasculitis, that I'm a person with a sense of humor, that I'm a person in a job, that I'm a person. I'm not a sick person necessarily.
So that's been one of your personal strategies of how to manage your disease. Let's move on and discuss what things you've done to to take care of your body and your mind. You've done all sorts of things. So what do you think are good, healthy behaviors that you've learned over these 14 years?
I think that you have to embrace a sense of wellness. I think to constantly think of yourself as sick is not helpful or healthy. So you really need to think of yourself as a well person. You need to eat well. One of the patients that I talked with said that when she isn't feeling well, that she feels like she might be going into a flare, that she really tries to work on her diet, i.e. no sugar, no caffeine, no alcohol. Another patient told me that she tries at that point to eat more fish and more chicken, less red meat. Exercise is very important. I know it's hard when you're not feeling well, and in my case, it's hard because my airway's not great. But find something to keep yourself moving. One woman who has joint problems, for instance, does swimming. Exercise helps you physically, but it also helps you mentally because it gets you out of yourself. It gets you out of your mind. Two of the things that I do are yoga and I do meditation, both of which help me a lot. I also walk.
So let's talk about one other thing that many, many patients do. And you've already alluded to it, and that's the afternoon nap. Fatigue is hugely part of this disease, as it is with any autoimmune disease. The tendency of some people is to try to push through that fatigue, but I think it might be almost impossible to do that at certain times.
It is, and I think that's one of the hard things about this disease is to accept limits. Know that you will reach them, that you will reach them with your body. You have to think of things like an energy bank, and that if you're going to make a withdrawal, i.e. you're going to go to a concert or move or an event or something, you have to make a deposit, i.e. a nap. So planning ahead, knowing that you're going to have a really active weekend, then get extra rest or build in some downtime in that weekend so that you can get a nap or just put your feet up so you're not constantly on the go and wearing yourself down.
Does that help with the physical parts of this disease as well as the mental ones?
It does, because when you're tired, it's just not good emotionally, mentally. You're more fragile. You're more prone to be moody and be sad. So it's just very stressful and frustrating when you're really tired. So finding a way to cope with fatigue is very, very important.
You, when you first started, again, many, many years ago, were really worried about needles. If you recall, the thought of having a blood draw was almost insurmountable at one point in time. That turns out to be a pretty common fear, but everybody has an anxiety about one thing or another. How did you deal with your needle phobia? Because you certainly have dealt with it remarkably well. And how would you help patients in general deal with anxieties that occur just as part of their daily life or part of the medical routine?
For my needle phobia, which I still have, when I go to get my blood drawn, I still have to lie down. And they always sort of look at me. I know I've done this before. I know you've drawn my blood 100 times, but I have to lie down. I just tell them, because the first time I had the problem, I actually went to see a friend who is a psychologist. And I said, help me with needle stuff because I'm phobic about this and I'm going to have a lot of needles. And he told me to try to take myself somewhere else. So I tell the person who's drawing my blood, okay, you just say 1, 2, 3, and I go to the beach. And I don't look. I look away. And then they say, okay, it's over. And it's over. So I think you need to figure out the things that stress you about your medical care and about your life and try to find ways to relax or to cope, because these things aren't going to go away. You've got to figure out a way to get through them and cope with them.
And with respect to those anxious moments, what would you do if you can't get through those? You said you went to see a psychologist. What? Just let's expand on that whole psychological help sphere for a minute. What would you advise people to do with respect to seeking psychological help?
I feel like a lot of people think that they need to get through this alone, that they're strong, they're tough, they can handle it. But at a certain point, I think, you know, some people do get depressed. You actually saw that in me and sent me to someone, and it helped enormously. I think people think that it's a sign of weakness if you have to get help, and it's not at all. I think counseling or talking to someone, it's someone impartial. You can really clarify the issues, and it's someone with whom you can be completely honest. I think most patients tend to shield a certain amount from your family, from your friends, but with a counselor, you can open up and be really, really honest and take off that brave face for a little while and really talk through the issues that you're facing and figure out ways to work with them.
I almost think that everybody who has a chronic illness, especially one that relapses and remits, needs some kind of counseling intervention. I don't think it needs to happen from a psychologist or a psychiatrist. It does need to be somebody who is separable from your nuclear family. It could be somebody in a church. It could be somebody who has other kinds of training, just so that they can help you through those moments of sadness or anger. I can't imagine anybody who has one of these diseases who several months prior to having a diagnosis was completely well, who isn't somehow disturbed by what's happened to them, especially with a disease process that we can't use the word cure. We can use the word long-term remission. But that's got to bugger up one's brain.
It does. And someone very wise wrote a book called A Whole New Life. It's by a man named Reynolds Price, who is a cancer patient. And he was talking about making a whole new life. And I just want to read just a little bit. Generous people, true practical saints, are waiting to give you everything on earth but your main want, which is simply the person you used to be. But you're not that person now. Grieve for a decent limited time over whatever parts of your old self you know you'll miss. Have one hard cry if the tears will come. Next, find your way to be somebody else, the next viable you, a stripped-down, whole, other, clear-eyed person.
Yeah. Reynolds Price is a wonderful writer, so that's an incredibly eloquent description of what needs to happen. That's right. In other words, those words, even though they apply to, in Reynolds Price's case, of somebody with a cancer, apply to anybody who has a serious medical condition that's not immediately going to go away. You have, of all people, worked tremendously on support networks. You were the president of the Vasculitis Foundation. You've been very much involved locally, nationally, and internationally in the support network concept. How would you then suggest for somebody who is brand new to the whole vasculitis experience to find support groups, to find other individuals with whom they can commune?
The Vasculitis Foundation has all of these support groups nationally and internationally listed on their website. They also have contact people, area contact people, with phone numbers and email addresses. I think it's very, very helpful. I will tell you that I was afraid to go to a support group for a while. I was afraid to go to my first symposium because I didn't know if I could handle it. I didn't know what I would see there. I didn't know if everybody there was going to be really depressed and look terrible and be really sick, and it would scare me to death. But I did. I went, and it was very, very helpful. I think having a support network, be it a formal support group or just talking with another patient over time, is really, really important because it really helps you not to be isolated. you can learn a lot. You can learn how other people cope with this disease. You can learn how other people manage symptoms, or just learning about a symptom that you maybe thought you had or didn't have. And also just being with people who know what you're going through, who are going through the same thing. There's a certain comfort level there. So I think it's really important, but I know it isn't, a group isn't for everyone, but I think having some support from maybe another patient would be fabulous.
So the value of a support group is the ability to know that there are others who are in the same, undergoing the same kinds of difficulties. Support groups also tend to have educational events too, where some important either medical topic or coping concept is usually described. Seems like that is as useful in the support group arena as anything else.
It is. Some of our groups meet, just to get together. Our group is really fortunate to have UNC and Duke right here, and the doctors and nurses and staff, everyone are very, very generous with your time. Another way that people have a chance to get together is at the International Symposium. That's a great way to learn everything you need to know about vasculitis and meet loads of people.
And at that last International Vasculitis meeting, all of us learned how to do in-the-chair massage, which I must confess I have repeated on a number of occasions. That was a learning experience, not just for patients, but for everybody in the audience.
That's right. It was a great
moment. Let's go back to this concept of finding a new normal. This is this Reynolds-Price concept. How practically do you find a new normal? How do you figure out when ill, when to go back to work? If you're going to go back to work, how do you make the decision? Well, maybe I ought to have a temporary or maybe a longer period retirement. How do you go about that whole thinking process?
I think you have to consider your body, your illness. I think you need to talk with your physician. I think you need to talk with your family. I know one patient who was also taking care of her ill mother, and she decided that between that stress and time commitment and her full-time job, that the best thing for her health would be to retire, and she did. Other people may decide to go on disability, but I think you have to see what's going to work for you and what's really important in your life. One woman said, I know that with disease, it's going to limit my life somewhat, so with the time I have left, how do I want to spend it? What's most important to me? And that's a question that you need to ask. If you have to work, then try to work it in your job so that it's doable for you, or you may consider changing careers or do something part-time.
How do you help your spouse find the new normal when one person has a chronic illness, or especially a relapsing and remitting one? The spouse also must find a new normal. What's the way that you have figured out to get your spouse, or suggest others to get their spouses to help them, not to feel pity, but yet to be there when they're needed to support them? So many issues around spousal new normal.
I think the first thing that patients need to think about is that it is okay to accept help. It doesn't mean that you're a weak person. And people who are around someone who is ill, that's what they want to do. They want to help. And I think letting people help you, letting a spouse help you, is important. You don't have to do this alone. It's impossible to do alone. And I think getting over that hurdle of, I don't want to bother somebody. He's busy. I don't feel like I can ask him that. You need to understand that helping is something that helps not only you, but the person who wants to help you. I think in terms of a new normal, I think that it's learning to compromise together. It's learning to say, well, gosh, it would be great if we could do A, B, and C, but, you know, maybe I could do A with you, and then you could do B, and maybe I could join you for C. It's working out what's going to keep you in your best condition, but also keeping that relationship strong and viable.
It doesn't just apply to the spouse. It also applies to kids, to the children of especially of moms who are ill. It seems that persistent worry that the mom won't be there for the kid. They won't be able to participate in whatever activity they were normally able to participate in. It seems as though parents need to give themselves permission to perhaps be a little less frenetic and get to some events, but not necessarily all. The goal needs to be for the kid to see the parent as they grow up over time, not necessarily for each individual activity that the parent would normally go to. That's probably, from what I've observed, one of the biggest new normals, the guilt of the parent not being able to participate in all the kid's activity and the fear of the child that their parent isn't necessarily going to make it. And how come mom or dad isn't able to be here? Or how the more worrisome thing actually in adolescent kids is the concern of why is this happening to my parent? Why isn't it happening to somebody else's parent? And actually the anger that goes along with that, especially in adolescent children of whose parent has this disease, I've encouraged that adolescent to get counseling very early on.
One patient told me that her child was supposed to read to her. Her daughter was supposed to read to her at night. And there were nights when she was just so exhausted she couldn't do it. So she had her daughter call her mother, well, her grandmother. And that was how the reading got done at night. It was a way to get it done, but that way the patient didn't have to do it, but she could sit there with her daughter while it was going on.
And if it's not a member of a related family, that's a great thing for a friend to come and do. Just being there in certain extent at important times and then knowing when to leave are useful things as well. So lastly, the question of how to find a place for vasculitis and keeping it in its place. How do you make it so it doesn't rule your life?
Well, I talked with quite a few people about this. You just worry. You always worry. And so one friend has a worry list. She sets aside a certain time or a time each day where she lists her worries, things that she can do about it, and then she puts the list away and goes about her business. Another person worries about, should I take a vacation? Should I not take a vacation? So buy travel insurance. Go ahead and do the things that you want to do. I think another thing that people think about is, what can I do with this? Now that I've had this disease, you know, what can I do in a positive way? And I think there's where becoming an advocate can help. Doing something about it, you feel like you're doing something positive for yourself and for the disease to increase awareness.
Vasculitis Awareness Day.
Yes.
Right. Good. Well, Dan, this has been a fascinating discussion. I want to thank you for one of our more enjoyable podcasts.
Thank you for including me.
Thank you.